Where did ketchup come from? How about ice cream or macaroni? And what does macaroni have to do with macaroons? We probably don't have enough time to explore all those questions right now with Dan Jurafsky, but he does in his book, The Language of Food, A Linguist Reads the Menu. He also tells us why we call a menu, a salad, and a toast. Professor Jurafsky is a Stanford linguist and computer scientist, and he joins us from Stanford. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Robert.
And let's start with ketchup. Tell us about ketchup's origins in China.
Well, ketchup was originally a fish sauce, just like modern Vietnamese fish sauce. In the 17th century, English and Dutch sailors, traders, they're sailing to Asia, and they brought home barrels of this Chinese fish sauce, and this fish sauce was called ketchup. Jup is a word for sauce in Chinese dialects. And so in England, ketchup lost the fish and acquired tomatoes, and much later on, the Americans added sugar, and there's our national condiment.
And you write that the migration of ketchup out of China, far from being mere curiosity, actually forces historians to rethink just how shut off China was from the rest of the world at that time.
Yeah, the traditional view of economic history says that in the Ming Dynasty, China turned inward and had to be dragged into the modern global world by Europe much later. But the story of ketchup tells us that China was really the center of world trade, and we know all that, and there it is in just this one Chinese word for ketchup that we still use every day.
We should just note in passing, as you do, that Marco Polo did not introduce pasta to Europe after supposedly discovering it in China.
That is true. That is a fun and humorous myth that was created in a marketing piece in the 20s. But in fact, pasta had been sold throughout Europe for 100 or 200 years before Marco Polo came back from China.
I was going to call it a canard, but that could lead us in a whole different direction, so
yes,
I won't.
Yes, I'll duck that one.
I learned from your book that the original ice cream flavor was orange blossom, and making it owed something to the development of gunpowder. Explain that one.
Yes, well, so the key ingredient in gunpowder is saltpeter. It was actually in China that they first figured out that saltpeter, also called potassium nitrate, could be mixed with sulfur and coal to create gunpowder. And that's, of course, where fireworks came from originally.
And then in Syria, there is yet another chemical development involving saltpeter.
Yeah, sometime in around the 13th century in Damascus, Syrian chemists figured out that saltpeter was a refrigerant. You could add it to water and it made the water cold. This was used in all sorts of Muslim countries in Mughal India as a way of cooling water. You put saltpeter in the water, and then you put a jug of water inside this saltpeter and water. It's the same technology that's used in modern cold packs.
This is before using actual ice. Saltpeter was used to chill.
Well, you could use ice, but ice is expensive. You have to bring it down from the mountains. You have to store it in these ice houses. So ice has certainly been used. They've been storing ice in ice houses for thousands and thousands of years. It's mentioned in the Bible, but saltpeter is much cheaper.
Here's a question that I have about the source material for your study of the language of the food, certainly for the older language of food. You cite many recipes from old cookbooks in English, French, Arabic, hundreds of years ago. Considering how few people could read in those days, are we, in fact, getting more of a glimpse of what the 1% of its time ate, as opposed to what ordinary people were scrounging up for a meal?
That's absolutely true. The recipes we have are the recipes of the courts and the rich people. But one fabulous fact about food is that things that start with the rich trickle down to the poor.
Now, I should add that your book, in addition to charting the history of food and how we talk about food, has some other features. And one that I'd like you to talk about is what the computational analysis of contemporary American restaurant menus tells us about the priciness of the restaurant and the vocabulary of the menu.
Yes, it turns out we looked at 6,500 menus across America, and it turns out that the words on the menu tell you a lot about the priciness of the restaurant and even the price of the individual dish. For example, as you can imagine, expensive restaurants are 15 times more likely to tell you where the food comes from, to mention the grass-fed things or the name of the farm or green market cucumbers. But expensive restaurants also use fancy, difficult words like tonnarelli or choclo or bastilla. But these expensive menus, they're shorter. The really long menus, those are the middle-priced restaurants. They're stuffed with adjectives, so fresh, rich, mild, crisp, tender, golden brown. and it's the cheapest restaurants, they're going to use those positive but vague words. That's your delicious, tasty, savory. So the idea is that the high-status restaurant, they want their customers to just assume the food is going to be fresh and delicious. If you say it's fresh and delicious, that's kind of implying you have to be convinced.
Right. If we're sitting down at a very expensive restaurant and the menu says, our scrumptious veal, we know something is off-key there at that
exactly.
point.
Exactly.
Well, Dan Jurafsky, thanks a lot for talking with us about the book.
Thanks so much, Robert. Thanks for having me.
The book is The Language of Food, A Linguist Reads the Menu.
Our Found Recipe series returns today with a story about a man, his friend, and some pork.
I can make a decent carnitas, and I've even roasted a whole pig in my backyard. But one dish that's eluded me is a favorite of my parents who grew up in China and Taiwan, Hong Sao Rou.
Hong Sao Rou, red braised pork. Oliver Wang usually reviews music for us, but today he wants to talk food, and we're going to let him.
Last fall, I went to Shanghai to attend the wedding of an old friend.
Hi, I'm Gary Wang from Shanghai, China.
Gary and his wife Eileen wrote their own vows, and this is how Gary's vows began. To translate, he basically said, before I met you, my loves were good music and pig meat. Gary owns the Shanghai eatery called The Grumpy Pig.
I named Grumpy Pig because I'm grumpy.
I asked him about his favorite pork dish, Hong Sao Rou, a.k.a. red braised pork. It's actually more of a deep brown, made from bite-sized morsels of pork belly, layered with skin, fat, and meat, all deliciously braised in a salty, sweet sauce to become melt-in-your-mouth tender.
It's very savory, and, you know, the sauce of Hong Sao Rou is really, really good with the rice, white rice.
Hong Sao Rou is incredibly common throughout China, yet Gary says no one outside of the country seems to get it right. He recently went to a Chinese restaurant in San Jose, California, and sampled their version. Problem one.
They cut the pork belly pieces too small. Really, really small.
Problem two.
Not sweet enough. It's pretty salty.
And problem three.
They put cornstarch in that dish, which is, I really hate it.
Gary takes his Hong Sao Rou seriously and says that another problem he's encountered outside of China is that you need more than just one kind of soy sauce. You need Lao Chou and you need Sheng Chou.
Lao Chou is a dark and Sheng Chou is a lighter. And Lao Chou basically give the meat the dark color instead of the saltiness.
Gary doesn't even serve the dish at the Grumpy Pig. They don't have the right gas stoves to make the way he thinks is proper, but he has been thinking of opening up a second restaurant here in the States. Maybe once that happens, there'll finally be someplace outside of China where Gary can find his hometown's Hong Sao Rou done right. In the meantime, I got his recipe, and I'm giving it a try.
That's Oliver Wang, who's sharing his friend's recipe for Hong Sao Rou on our Found Recipes page. It's at npr.org. And here's a tip. Those soy sauces are key to this dish, and they can be found in specialty stores or online. Enjoy! A few environmentally minded companies are rolling out products with edible packaging. The idea is, why dump tons of waste into landfills when the container your food comes in could be part of the snack? But one product about to be rolled out in stores in the Northeast demonstrates just how tricky that is. Sam Evans-Brown of New Hampshire Public Radio explains.
Yeah, we'll try one of those.
On opening day of the first Whole Foods store in Nashua, New Hampshire, Stonyfield handed out free samples of a new frozen yogurt novelty.
Yeah, the skin was so
it tastes
soft.
Like almost like an Italian strawberry Italian ice on the outside.
Very good. Who invented this?
The product Jane Dragoni and Debbie Farrell are trying is called a Wiki Pearl. They're bite-sized frozen yogurt balls surrounded by a gel-like edible skin made of fruit or coconut particles and a seaweed extract held together by a fancy, science-y process.
If you had a function, this is a great end to a cookout anything.
The idea that led to the pearls is straight out of Willy Wonka. What if you could make food in a package that you could eat, just like a grape or a cherry tomato? So it's more than a little ironic that when you walk inside the Nashua Whole Foods, you find the Wiki Pearls almost individually wrapped, two yogurt balls per bag.
Conceptually, it is edible packaging.
Eric Friedman is the senior vice president of marketing at Wikifoods, which makes the skin for Stonyfield's pearls.
The product could be merchandised on shelves with no packaging and no plastics.
He says in an ideal world, the pearls would be in a bulk food bin and you would scoop them into your own little reusable container. Even though so far retailers have insisted on packaging, Friedman says he thinks consumers are ready to ditch the plastic.
We just need to find the right environment to introduce the product in its kind of purest form.
That environment could be more like a restaurant or at a buffet where you could serve them with tongs. Certainly that would ease the mind of consumers like Michael Bates.
Well, I think you have to be careful. People putting, shoving their hands in or trying one thing, it's cold, and dropping it back in and stuff like that. I mean, I don't mind having a little bit of packaging because it makes the product hygienic and safer.
The pearls are already on offer in 5 Whole Foods stores in New England. By the end of the month, they'll be available in 35 Whole Foods in New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut. But how much of this talk of edible packaging is simply marketing?
So the skins are melt-free and mess-free.
Eric Friedman of Wikifood says they can be enjoyed on the go and in places where you can't bring regular frozen yogurt because of the skin.
But they do not need to be frozen.
But when I let a couple of them thaw here in the studio, after 40 minutes, the filling oozed out of one, leaving a puddle of yogurt with what looked like a deflated jellyfish on top. Packaging expert Sarah Risch says that could be because frozen foods can partially thaw and refreeze as many as 6 times when traveling from the manufacturer to our freezers.
Where it may have been perfect if you kept it perfectly frozen, the moisture from inside the product can start basically degrading the barrier layer that they have.
Risch, for one, thinks there are reasons to be skeptical of the whole idea of edible packaging. The food that is already in its own skin, fresh fruits and vegetables, is the food that spoils the most quickly. Risch worries unless edible packaging can be refined to the point where it works as well as plastic, it might simply mean swapping throwing away plastic for throwing away more rotting food. So for now, just like pierogies and dumplings, Wiki Pearls are restricted to the freezer aisle in a bag. For NPR News, I'm Sam Evans-Brown in Concord, New Hampshire.
Nutella, the sinfully indulgent chocolate hazelnut spread, turns 50 this year. It has become a global phenomenon, so successful that it now drives demand for one of its main ingredients, hazelnuts. As a result, people are trying to grow hazelnuts in new places, even New Jersey. NPR's Dan Charles reports.
In Midtown Manhattan, inside a shrine to Italian food called Italy, there's an actual Nutella bar. New Yorkers and tourists alike are lining up to order Nutella on bread, Nutella on a croissant, Nutella on crepes. Italy's Dino Bori explains the culinary concept here.
We create a simple place. Simple ingredient, few ingredient, with Nutella, super tasty, super simple. When you are simple, the people love.
Nutella was the product of hard times. During World War II, an Italian chocolate maker named Ferrero couldn't get enough cocoa, so he decided to mix in some ground hazelnuts instead. Then he made a soft and creamy version.
It was like one of the greatest inventions in the last century.
Nutella was.
It's a bold claim, of course, but you have to admit, greatness is a matter of taste. In any case, over the past 50 years, Nutella conquered Italy and then the whole world. The recipe for world domination, it turns out, is not too complicated. Sugar, cocoa, palm oil, and hazelnuts. 3 of those 4 things are easy to get. Sugar, cocoa, and palm oil are produced in huge quantities. Hazelnuts, though, which some people call filberts, most of them come from just one place.
The vast majority of hazelnuts are grown in Turkey, in the hillsides surrounding the Black Sea.
This is Karim Azawi, an executive with the Turkish company Balsu USA, which supplies hazelnuts to the U.S. He describes the scene. Hazelnut trees, they're more like bushes, grow on steep slopes that rise from the Black Sea coast. The farms are small. Grandparents and children help to harvest the nuts, usually by hand.
It's a very traditional way of life.
Farmers have been growing hazelnuts here for 2,000 years.
The Turkish family farmers producing hazelnuts are extremely proud of the hazelnut crop, as it has been part of their family histories for centuries.
But Nutella has made what's traditional trendy. The company that makes Nutella, Ferrero, now claims about a quarter of all the world's hazelnuts, more than 100,000 tons of them every year. It's pushed up hazelnut prices. And this year, there was a late frost in Turkey that froze the hazelnut blossoms and cut Turkey's hazelnut production in half. So prices have spiked even further. They're up another 60%. Because they're so valuable, more people now want to grow them. Farmers are growing hazelnuts in Chile and Australia. America's hazelnut orchards in Oregon are expanding. And there are even a few growing where commercial hazelnuts have never grown before in the eastern United States. They're on a research farm that Rutgers University operates just outside New Brunswick in New Jersey. Tom Molnar, a plant breeder at Rutgers, shows me around an oasis of orchards in between highways.
All the green leafy things you see here are hazelnut trees, but in the beginning, they all died from disease.
The disease is eastern filbert blight, caused by a fungus.
Here's a good example of what eastern filbert blight does to a European hazelnut.
This tree is a corpse. It got about as big as a short bush before the fungus attacked, rupturing the bark around each branch. You really can't escape this fungus in the eastern part of the U.S., so everybody knew you cannot grow European hazelnuts here. But about 10 years ago, another plant breeder at Rutgers, Tom Molnar's mentor, decided to try anyway. He and Molnar went looking for trees that could survive eastern filbert blight.
I personally went and made a number of seed collections in eastern Europe, and in Russia, Poland, Ukraine, and brought back thousands of seeds and grew them as we normally would, and I would say 98% of them died.
The other 2%, though, did not. Molnar cross-pollinated these blight-resistant trees with other hazelnut trees from Oregon that produce lots of high-quality nuts. He collected the offspring of that mating, looking for individual trees with the ideal genetic combination, blight resistance and big yields. He shows me a few of those possibilities.
This tree here is a good example of some of our better material.
He pulls down a branch and shows me the nuts. Each one is hidden inside a leafy husk.
They look quite a bit like acorns, but they taste much better, I promise that.
Molnar is waiting to see just how productive these trees turn out to be. He's optimistic. And Ferrero, the Nutella maker, is also intrigued.
Actually, they've come here several times, and they're interested. They told me if we can meet their quality specifications, they would be interested in buying all the hazelnuts we could produce.
So stay tuned. If you just want to grow hazelnuts in your backyard, though, Tom Molnar does have one other warning.
I haven't seen any other food that drives squirrels more crazy than hazelnuts.
Squirrels will do almost anything to get their greedy little paws on the nuts before you do. Molnar says your hazelnuts may need a guard dog, one that likes to chase squirrels. Dan Charles, NPR News.